This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org.
Holy Mother, wonderful reading. Thank you.
It's a wonderful introduction, Naomi.
I was interested in the repeated references tonight to all that is not known, because that was something I really wanted to talk about with you. And perhaps this has to do with the season, once again. You have said the two sides of existence are always there in a poem. There's what you know, but the source is what you don't know. I've also heard you say all poetry comes from listening. What you're listening for is what you don't know. Sometimes it seems that what we don't know is hardly what culture respects most, or headlines, public dialogue. A few years ago, I was very taken with the Szymborska poem where she talks about how much that simple phrase, I don't know, could help us if we would only trust in it as human beings. And it seems in your poems that you have trusted in it and allowed it to lead you so many places. Would you be willing?
Well, I've felt for a long time, and you know, if you have these notions, they tend to, and if they're really yours, they tend to go on growing with you. I've had the feeling that what we know is very, very remarkable, but it's a very tiny part of this enormous universal thing of what, not only what we don't know, but what we never will know, and what is indeed, in every sense that we understand it, unknowable. I'm not a philosopher, so I'm not going to put it in metaphysical, in nice metaphysical terms. But the ways we tend to think of ourselves, and the things that we use and need to use practically for everything in our lives involve what we know. We need what we know. We need to respect what we know. We need to pay attention to it. We need a good education plan. We need all of these things, you know. But finally, it's what a great Chinese master said in the 9th century. He said, it's like a hair floating in empty space. I mean, it's so small. It's so little. And it's... it's also very deceptive, because what you know can hide what you don't know and make you think that it's the real thing, and it isn't. It's only an aspect of the real thing. It's something that allows you to have a relation with the real thing, but it isn't the real thing itself. The real thing is always what you don't know. It's always this immense unknown that frightens us, you know, that, we know it chiefly as something that is frightening. And of course, what we think of as the ultimate unknown, we think of death, you know, as being the ultimate unknown. It is, but it's only, even death is only part of the unknown. And this is so enormous that we can't envisage it. And the imagination, which goes beyond knowledge, it moves closer to the unknown, and of course comes out of the unknown.
You mentioned the fear. Do you think that fear is what causes so many people, whether in poetry or in other kinds of lives, to back away from the unknown, or say, I'll hold to that little hair and I won't listen to the other?
I think so. Yeah, because of course, uncertainty is the beginning of the unknown, the recognition of uncertainty. Uncertainty is the recognition of the beginning of the unknown. And if you're not on good terms with it, if you're full of anxiety anyway, that's where your anxiety begins. I mean, that's the ocean of your panic and of your fright and so forth. But there are other ways of approaching it. And I think that it's one of the salutary things about the arts is that the arts are dealing with the unknown in quite a different way. They're saying, it's okay, you know, you can treat the unknown as, you can regard the unknown as not God the Father, but as a great mother, you know, that says, you know, it's going to be all right. Mm-hmm. There's some, you didn't know where it came from in the first place, and look what you got. And you don't know where it's going, and don't figure that you have to know too much. There's a wonderful thing in part of the Pali Canon where one of the students says to the Buddha, "I'm going to leave you, Master." And he said, "Why are you going to leave me?" He said, "Well, you haven't told us about whether there's a life after death. You haven't told us about all these different things, but particularly about whether there's life after death." And the Buddha says, "Did I ever say that I would tell you about life after death?" "Well, no, you didn't say that." "And did I ever tell you that I would tell you these other things?" "No, you didn't say that you were going to say that. But I wanted to know." "Well," he said, "the reason I didn't tell you was because you don't need to know those things. What you need to know is what I've told you."
It's wonderful. It's really nice. Could you talk a little bit about your form, how it's grown, and through the known and the unknown of all the forms that you have worked with? In the early poems, the very earliest poems, the very formal, tightly managed, wonderfully adept forms, and then moving to a more open line, internal spacing, the lyric, the narrative coming back in. It seems to me that very few poets have been as diverse as you have been in terms of the passage through different forms and respecting them and working with them, but finding your own distinctive form and really maintaining an allegiance to it. And I think all of the poems, even if they may have different lengths and different kinds of topics, but there has been a voice that is so much yours. And yet it's not necessarily the voice one would have heard in the first few books.
I'm obviously fascinated by the formal aspect of poetry. And I think of the form in, I suppose, quite unorthodox ways. I think that the formal possibilities of poetry at any point are infinite. I mean, they're not. I've always shied away from anybody, and as you know, in my generation, there have been a number of people who would say, it has to be this kind of poem or it isn't a poem. And it has to be formal, or it has to be not formal, or it has to be this or that. It has to have such and such and such. They're all wrong. I mean, it doesn't have to be any of those things. It has to be something probably that it will determine by itself. But I think that's true of forms, too. I think that the formal possibilities are infinite. We only know a few of them. And that there is no such thing as a bad form. They become conventional, they become habitual, and they blunt the way habits always do. But I think that a poem for me eventually determines the form that it's going to have. It may start out in one form and then say, no, that's not right. It's supposed to be a different kind of form. I love disguising forms and making it seem to be informal when it, in fact, is very formal. And I believe also that two things about it I've come to realize. I believe that a form is a liberation. It's not a straitjacket. If you find that it's a straitjacket, it's not a form. You're torturing yourself. There's no reason to do that. But actually, a real form brings out things that in the subject that would not have been brought out in another way. And you know, Baudelaire said, if you find that meter and rhyme, he was talking about it in a very conventional way. But if you find that meter and rhyme are consistently working against you, you probably aren't a poet. You know, you probably or do it some other way. There's a very formal poet of my generation, a year older than I, James Merrill, who died a few years ago, whose poetry I admire enormously. And I feel close enough in some ways to some of James's poems to look at lines and figure that I can sort of guess passages of evolution, of how that line came to be there, you know. But it's the formality that mm-hmm. makes it possible. But the other side of it is that if you if it happens, if it works, there's no reason to think it's going to work again, you know. And if you start deciding that because it worked, it's going to work again, then it's going to, it's certainly going to work against you, and you're going to go deaf to it. And you better pay attention to the next poem and say, do you want to be that kind of form, or do you want to, or do you want to be something else, you know?
I still very much like something you said in 1969 in the Naked Poetry Anthology, where you said, what are called here open forms are in some concerns the strictest. Here only the poem itself can be seen as its form. I like that. You still like that?
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know whether I like that, but I think that.
You still think that. Young readers discovering your poems, and I've enjoyed being with many teenagers who read your poems for the first time, and that feeling of wanting to clutch the pages to their hearts and carry them with them everywhere is one that we all can appreciate. But one thing they often want to talk about is the beautiful lack of cluttered punctuation in your poems, since it's often something they've had trouble with in their own writing. But of course they can see that what you're doing with it is not simply abandoning it, but using the space, the sense of the air around the space, around the poem, in as another kind of punctuation. And so there really is punctuation, but it's not with commas and periods, semicolons, so forth. Do you still like that image about punctuation being staples holding the poem to the page, and without it the poem has a larger life?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah.
I think in the first place, I think of not using punctuation, which, by the way, that it's not a credo. I don't think that other people should abandon punctuation. I don't know whether they should or shouldn't. I mean,
right.
That's up to them.
Well, but many want to, wouldn't they?
I hope it looks easy.
It's very hard. It's very hard.
But the thing that I realized as I came to it was that writing without punctuation was in itself a form. That it is a form. It has a formal demand, and one of the formal demands is that if you don't have punctuation, you have to do it in another way. And how you do it is by the movement and sound of the language. But it has to be the spoken and heard language.
That's right.
It pulls it away from prose. Right. And punctuation, after all, really is the protocol of prose.
That's right.
And that's not to say anything bad about it. I mean, it's a very valuable thing, and when I write prose, I use it. I hope I use it all right. But actually, it's a mixture of philosophy and manners, punctuation. But grammar is pure philosophy. It also, to me, represented always something that I feel very strongly, which is that poetry is physical in the sense that prose may or may not be. It doesn't have to be. You have to hear poetry. If you don't hear Shakespeare, I don't know how some scholars manage to read Shakespeare all their lives and clearly have never heard it at all. You know, I mean, I've heard a few times scholars talk about Shakespeare, and I don't think you ever heard a thing. I mean, I don't know why you're teaching or studying Shakespeare. Is there no passion in this thing? And the passion comes, it's physical. It comes from hearing it. And the strange thing about poetry that I don't understand is that it begins with a sense. It begins with one of the senses. It doesn't begin with the mind. It begins with hearing something. I mean, writing a poem for me begins with, and then reading a poem. There are poems of Yeats and poems of Blake and other poems that I got to the point of memorizing, and I didn't really know what they were doing, but I sort of heard something as I read them, and I couldn't stop hearing it. And that to me, it's a kind of mantric power that is in that language. And it doesn't have anything to do with punctuation, and it doesn't have, but it has to do with hearing.
And hearing as opposed to, say, starting out with an idea. That's not where poetry begins for you. No.
I think that hearing is something that you, and hearing is something that you hear not only with your ears, but then you begin to hear it with your whole body. I mean, it's a vibration that you pick up.
Even as a child, were you reading what you wrote out loud to yourself?
Mm-hmm.
Always. Was someone else reading poetry to you?
My mother read Robert Louis Stevenson and Tennyson's The Brook, and I'm afraid Longfellow. I don't mean to put down Longfellow, but the poems, the things that we know of Longfellow are really sort of too bad. It's too bad that anybody is remembered for those. But you know, if you want to, but read these sonnets about Chaucer. They're beautiful, and they're lovely things, and they're lovely lines and passages in Longfellow. And his translation of Dante is probably one of the better translations of Dante.
So that spoken sound of poetry was always with you from early on.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes, I can still remember, listening to Stevenson. I still think that Where Go the Boats is one of the most beautiful poems in English. And
you memorized many poems when you were young.
Yeah.
Yeah, that you retain.
Yeah, don't you know that poem, maybe?
Not
dark,
by memory.
Dark brown is the river, golden is the sand. Mm-hmm. It flows along forever with trees on either hand.
It's a loss not to be doing that in schools, don't you think?
Well, the little time that I taught, I insisted that people find poems that they liked, and then memorize them, and then tell us why from memory they like those poems.
The little times that you taught, you never had a strong desire to teach, and you were able to live without doing it. And
well,
I think many, many people admire that in you.
So, you remember those old Disney films of Dippy walking off from the cliff and not realizing that he's in midair? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's kind of like that. But it wasn't that I had a thing against teaching, although I was very cautious about teaching when I was, you know, in my 20s and 30s, but at which I was cautious about an academic career and about getting caught in one. And I watched my contemporaries doing that and getting caught in an academic path, let's say, and not being able to see themselves any other way. Mm-hmm. And they began to get, you know, have house payments and mortgages and things like that, and I lived without any of those things, sort of hand to mouth. And I had a different set of examples in mind. I mean, I was thinking of the composers and poets of before the 20th century, who never thought they were going to have any money, and I thought, well, you know, I won't ever have any money. But this is what I really want to do.
And you've been so generous with all the translation. I think many people would have feared that it would take away time from their own writing, and yet you were always committed to it very early on through translating other people's work. So did it function for you not only as something you believed in, a dedication, but as a way of clearing your own pipes and keeping you alive to language in general for your own writing?
I think it did all kinds of things like that. As for time, I mean, I probably didn't spend more time translating than many of my contemporaries spent being academic, you know, writing papers and publishing or perishing and teaching. But I had this urge to find poetry of any kind, sometimes reading translations of non-literate languages, it was like listening for something very far away that you might just get a few notes mm-hmm. of, you know, but if they were real, you mm-hmm. know. And I was just so fascinated by all these different kinds of poetry, because I felt that poetry had to be of many, many kinds. And there must be many ways of trying to make this impossible thing happen in language.
And sometimes you had to collaborate with other people because you didn't speak all of the languages necessarily, but many times you did speak the languages. So was that a different process?
Yeah, it was. And translation, of course, is... I don't think one can say it too often. I mean, when people say to you with a smile, you know, well, of course, it's impossible to translate poetry, isn't it? You know, you say, of course it is, you know. Absolutely impossible. But that's not... But we don't do it because it's possible. We do it because it's necessary, and because it's unthinkable that we wouldn't do it. You know, that we have to try to do this.
And because we're always translating everything to begin with, aren't we?
Yeah. And the Dante. I mean, all my life I said you can't translate Dante, and I learned. I tried to read. I carried Dante around in my pocket for years. In a bilingual edition and memorize long things of Dante. I thought, you can't, but his translation's ridiculous. And when I was asked to translate some Dante, I said, well, I've always said you can't do it. And then I, you know, tried, and nobody, of course, you can't do it. But you can get closer. You can give, I mean, at least I hope you can. I wanted a translation always to convey some idea of why the original was worth translating. And there are many bad translations that don't. I mean, you think, well, you know, if the original is anyway like that, why bother to translate it? It's so boring. You know? Something must show you, whether it's the meaning or the sound or the originality of the thought. But I mean, it's not this boring thing that we're trying to plow through. And you have to do it differently.
And you never found it eroding your own sense of time for your own work, did you?
I suppose I did occasionally, and sometimes it was one of my ways of earning a living, too, translating. Because, I mean, you can translate for money. I don't know that you can write, I can't imagine writing poems for money, but it's a strange idea. But you could translate for money.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You actually became close to many of the people whom you translated, didn't you? You get to know them?
Some of them I became close to. Some of them I met only a few times. And one of the ones that I wish I had known a lot better was Jean Follin, a French poet who was born in 1903. And Copper Canyon's going to reprint his book of poems of his. He was a wonderful poet, and I think underrated. I mean, the French don't realize how wonderful a poet Follin was. He was that same generation as Michaud and Éluard and Satie and the composers in Paris. And not the first great breakthrough, not Apollinaire's generation, but sort of 10 years or 15 years younger than that. And I think he's a very beautiful and very, very original poet and very un-French in some ways.
In a recent poem of yours, The Wild, which I read only recently, I think it's a fairly recent poem, The Wild, where you talk about seeing the water through the trees, mm-hmm. and that sense of it, that image enduring through the years, it made me think about how William Stafford used to talk about those images in our childhoods which lean us toward poetry, if not telling us for sure that's what we'll do, giving us a sense that there's something out there worth yearning for, worth carrying, worth shaping into language. And I feel that many of your poems have helped us feel those images through your whole life, through what those images have been. Are there any particular ones from your childhood that you haven't written about much, but which you can continue to return to in your mind?
Yeah, there are. Camus said that we'll return to a very small number of dominating images, and every writer does that. And there are ones to do with people, but there's one that I think of often, and I have written about it, but I don't think I've ever conveyed it. I remember there was a farm that we used to go to when I was about 8 or 9, and it was a very kind of repressed childhood. But my mother and the woman, the farm woman who'd come there from somewhere else, were talking one afternoon. I was allowed to go for a walk by myself on the farm, and I remember the entire walk, and I remember finding my way out through the farm over the hill and over another hill, and then all of a sudden coming over this hilltop and seeing something. It was like a vision. I mean, I thought it was the most beautiful thing I'd ever seen in my life. It was just this enormous, great pasture flowing down into the woods with the late afternoon light, and just utterly silent. And it was really like seeing another dimension of existence. And I went back and tried to, I mean, I stood there for a long time, and I went back and tried to explain what I'd seen, and of course completely failed to do that. And I've still completely failed to do that.
I don't think so. But I think that's the feeling looking this faster that people feel when they read your poems, maybe. I think so.
You do.
They've walked up to that place. No, many people. I'm taking a poll. I know. Recently you were asked an interesting question for a project, I think, happening off the coast of Seattle. What poems by other poets, a few, you might select to put in places such as military submarines or enterprises where people are kind of at a pitch of high alert tension? And what would be some other poems by people you would choose to put there? And could you tell us about one you selected?
Well, yeah. The letter said that this was someone who was working, selling for a bookstore, books for the Puget Sound, for several Navy yards, and he'd been informed that the Trident submarine had a small library. Everyone did. What he may not even know, but my wife and I know because we were involved in a controversy to keep our county in Hawaii a nuclear-free zone, is that when a Trident submarine dives, it will stay submerged for 90 days. So that one's completely out of touch with any time except Greenwich time and with the surface, and there's no radio contact. There wasn't during that time. So, I mean, the psychological strain is enormous on the people down there. What were the poems? He said, I realize that it's ideas that make people push buttons. What books should they have on those shelves that might make them wonder about pushing the buttons? So the books are one thing. There's a list of five books he asked me to send. And the poems that I thought of sending, the two that I and didn't, were Shakespeare's Fear No More the Heat of the Sun, because I thought no one could push a button, whoever listens to that poem. And Dylan Thomas's great, great refusal to mourn the death by fire of a child in London, which I think is one of the great war poems ever written. But because I thought those two poems, by their very, for their language, were hard, difficult of access. But there was William Stafford's Earth Dwellers, that's a beautiful poem. And mostly they were very contemporary poems. Gerald Stern's The Dog, Hans Magnus Enzensberger's I Speak for None of Your Kind, I Speak for the Owls. And there's one I'm not remembering, but the fifth one was Emily Dickinson's I Reason Earth is Short, and Pain is Absolute, and Many Hurt.
It's a wonderful game.
But what of that? Yeah.
All the clods become precious in
yes,
that Stafford
that's
poem.
The Stafford poem.
All the clods. Just one last thing I'd like, well, many last things, but one thing I'm curious about, and I realize this is a hard question to answer, but I think it's one that many poets wonder or need to wonder. In the midst of all the places you've lived and all the poets you've lived among and all the people you've known, you have retained, we can tell you this even though it's not a kind of thing one would admit oneself, an amazing lack of self, just big self. You've maintained a humility, a kindness, a sense that you have served poetry in the way that it deserves to be served, and it has served you, therefore. There's been this interaction. And I'm curious what guiding signs you might suggest to poets caught up in the whirl, the clamor of their own selfhood or their own quest to be known or to share their work or all the questions that people ask poets. What guiding things would you say to them to remember?
Well, I've thought of this many times, you know, having to talk to students and to children, students of different ages, and thinking, I'm not very good at this. I'm not particularly wise nor experienced or anything. But the thing that I know is that you must respect what, find out what you really want to do and respect that and pay attention to that. Not pay attention only to other people's expectations. And, of course, not everybody can do this. Not everybody has the freedom to do it. But I really think, I remember years ago hearing of something that Bertrand Russell said when he was an older man. He said, if a poet cannot be independent, nobody on earth can be independent. And I thought, that's interesting. That means what he doesn't know, what even that philosopher doesn't realize that he said, is that a poet is responsible for being independent. Because a poet is a guardian of independence. And you have to give an example of doing it the way that you believe it has to be done. Because maybe nobody else can do it. You have to speak for people who cannot. You have to speak for any kind of life that cannot speak for itself. And you have to try to maintain that kind of freedom if you can, because it's not in self-indulgence. It's the important thing. It's paying attention.
Thank you for doing just that from all of us.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcast at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Haney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwidge Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.